Well, good morning, everyone. Why don't you just take a moment to greet one another around you and say good morning? And good morning. I wonder. If you've got your Bibles, let's turn to Luke chapter 1. Luke chapter 1, we're going to be doing 2 weeks to talk on Christmas. So I thought, what will we do? And I'm going to do, this week and next week, we're going to do the stories of Annunciation. That means that the stories where the angel Gabriel appears initially to Mary and then appears to Joseph and tells him or her that Jesus is coming. And so we're going to look at those two stories over the next couple of weeks. So we'll do Matthew's Gospel next week. But just as we're turning up to do that, can I mention a few things? The first thing is that next week is our Just Christmas Gift Day. And again, I would encourage you, not simply so that we can give money to help in terms of people trafficking in Cambodia and be working towards that. But just in terms of the amount of money that we spend at Christmas, as followers of Jesus, we really have a calling to set a slightly different example and reflect slightly different values. Now, don't get me wrong, I love Christmas. And I'm one of these people, you know, I don't get it when you turn to some people and they say, oh, we hate Christmas. I really don't understand that. So I love the present thing and I love eating and I love all that, as you can tell. And but nonetheless, as disciples of Jesus, we're called to something that's different. And that's why I love Just Christmas, even if we weren't doing Joe. I think we should be doing Just Christmas because as followers of Jesus, we should be celebrating his birthday in a way that actually pleases Jesus. And I'm not sure that the way that we always do it and the amount of money that we spend, I think I was saying last week, in Forth Valley alone, they believe that between the 4th of December and the end of the festive period, the average person will consume 30,000 more calories than they actually need. That's just in Forth Valley. You think about that. That's incredible. And so we're all already on it. So anyway, Just Christmas next week. So that was the appeal with Just Christmas. And encouraging you to slim down your Christmas and release some of the money. Tell people instead of buying you presents that you probably won't use, it's better off to give money and release the money. So that's next week, Just Christmas. The cafe's also on Saturday. And again, if you're in town shopping next Saturday, good to drop in for lunch and things. The second thing is we have loads of services coming up next week. And we have carols and lessons. We have Christmas Eve. We have Christmas Day. So a whole series of special services. And this is a great time to invite people. And there are invitations at the back. And I don't know if you are, but I'm trying to invite people. And meeting with me in church kind of responses and things. And but just invite folks along. The your best chance of getting anyone into church is actually during Christmas and coming along to one of these services. Anyway, let's turn to Luke chapter 1. And let's think a wee bit about this story of the angel appearing to Mary. One of the things that marked Christmas is the whole idea of family. My wife and I have a television in our kitchen, and I don't usually watch it there, but I've been noting that it's been set to channel 5 recently, and every time I walk in, there's like a Christmas movie on. So I turned to my wife, Susan, and I was saying, what's going on with these? And she's going, they're doing back-to-back Christmas movies now on Channel 5. Now, I haven't actually watched any of these Christmas movies, okay? But I guarantee that the essence of it will be filled with sort of Christmas sentimentality and the notion eventually being that everybody has a perfect Christmas with a perfect family and everybody is happy. We kind of all know that expectation, isn't it? And every year as we run up to Christmas, we're working towards making this day the best it possibly can be. And it's going to be, and we have this sort of idyllic image of the family together and sort of not quite round the piano singing Christmas carols, but hopefully at least switching off our iPhones for half an hour. And we have a younger member of our family. A few years ago, it was a couple of years ago, I actually requested that the iPad be switched off while we ate Christmas meals. And it got very tense in the room. And they were like, oh, okay. So I see how this operates nowadays. And the reality is that when our families get together, there is a little bit of tension, isn't there? And sometimes it is a little bit of stress. And we like to put on this facade, but actually it is papering over the cracks. And for an awful lot of people now, Christmas Day actually reflects not how wonderful family is, but actually how broken family is. And so we come to Christmas, and it just reminds us of actually how messed up some of our relationships are, how tense those relationships are, and why I never text my brother or my sister, or that's why I don't keep in touch with them. And it reminds us of all of that stuff. So family's kind of there in this perception that we have. Now, I want to suggest to you that actually the two stories that we have of the birth of Jesus in Matthew and Luke actually reflect a family tension. Okay, now you're going to have to come with me on this, all right? So this is a theory. You probably won't have read it anywhere, so which may suggest something that you need to evaluate what you're about to be told. But one of the big things that's really noticeable if you read the story of Luke and you read the story of Matthew is the absence of either Joseph or Mary in the respective stories. And we've just had a little bit of organized chaos here with the nativity. And we did the nativity, and you have the sheep and the angels and everything, and it's wonderful, and the kids are great. But if we were actually looking at the two stories of Matthew and Luke, you discover something quite remarkable. As you read the story of Matthew, the center character is Joseph. Okay, Joseph is there. He's the guy that all the action revolves around. He's the guy that the angels appear to. Everything happens. In fact, Mary says absolutely nothing in Matthew's gospel and is given a bit part, cursorily referenced. If we were doing it as a play, she would be off on the side somewhere. And then we turn to Luke's gospel, and it's like, whoa! Suddenly this bit player who's out here in Matthew's story suddenly is center stage, and everything rotates around Mary. So it's a fascinating contrast between the two stories. And people kind of have asked the question, why are they so different? Why have we got this difference? And why have we got such a focus on Joseph in Matthew's gospel and a focus on Mary in Luke's gospel? It's a good question to ask. Now, traditionally, some people have tried to explain it by saying that maybe Luke's gospel is Mary's story and Matthew's gospel is Joseph's story. That's why the story in Luke is four times as long. And I didn't say that. I'm sure that was a commentator somewhere. And And that's been the suggestion. However, that's highly improbable, and I can't explain to you why it's highly improbable, but it's not because of the period when these stories were probably getting written down. So why? Why do we have this contrast? Why do we have this contrast? Now, the fact is we don't really know, but I'm going to give you a suggested theory, okay? As I say, you probably won't read it anywhere else, so that may tell you the merit of this theory or not, but a suggestion. And actually, it was one of our church members that drew my attention to this. If we go to the time that the stories are being written down, when we think they're being written down, which is probably maybe 70, 80 years, maybe even more, after the events that are being described. And we look at what's happening in the church. There's something very interesting happening in the church in Jerusalem. And after the church in Jerusalem was run, or the senior pastor of the church in Jerusalem, was initially James, Jesus' brother. And he led that church. He led that church for more than 30 years after Jesus' crucifixion. And then James was martyred. And around about 62. And after he was martyred, he was killed. The next person to take over was another member of Jesus' family. It's interesting that in Jerusalem, succession seemed to be connected to family relationships, and the various members of Jesus' family actually were very prominent in the leadership of the church in Palestine. And the person who took over wasn't directly related to Jesus. Well, he was, but not an immediate sibling. It was actually Jesus' nephew. It was Joseph's brother's son. Right? That's interesting. Joseph's brother's son. In other words, the person who was running the church in Jerusalem was a relative of Joseph. And he actually ran the church there, they reckon, for 40 years. And he was a key figure. And unfortunately, a lot of the records of that church were lost because there were two massive revolts in Palestine, and it lost a lot of the tradition. But it's still there in church history. And he was called Simon, son of Cleopas. Cleopas is mentioned in John 19. Actually, you'll discover that Mary's sister is also mentioned there in John 19. Do you know what Mary's sister was called? Mary. I just wonder what Mary's parents, you know, they weren't very creative, were they? We just had another daughter. What would we call her? Mary. It's like, what? And James seems to be very popular on the other side. I'm not sure why. Anyway, but now, if you actually look at the story of that we find in Luke's gospel, story in Luke's gospel actually is a story about rejection. And we lose this because we're all told about the innkeeper. Remember the innkeeper? And we didn't actually have him in the nativity. We were doing a much more PC kind of nativity these days. And you know the stories that we got taught about Mary and Joseph and the donkey arriving in Bethlehem. All the B&Bs are booked up and there's no Airbnb available. And they go to the inn and he says, I haven't got any rooms. And they go and stay in the stable. You all know that, don't you? You all know that story. Of course, it doesn't appear anywhere in the New Testament. And the verses that it's based on, which are in Luke 2, actually are saying that not there was no room in the inn, but there was no room in the guest room. The inference in Luke is the same that you'll find in Matthew, which was that Joseph lived in Bethlehem with his family, and that when pregnant Mary came down from Nazareth to Bethlehem to have a baby, the family didn't want anything to do with her. Why didn't they want anything to do with her? Because she was pregnant out of wedlock. And now, even today, that would cause some ripples, although 40% of kids are now born out of wedlock. But back then, this was off Richter scale in terms of the shame factor. We often get, I always find it amazing as I watch the nativities, and I watch the story, and I think, do people actually understand just the trauma and actually what is being described here? A young girl pregnant without a husband in first century Palestine. It's just like horrific. And Joseph's family would have nothing to do with Mary. This is what Luke's suggesting. In fact, you know in Luke's gospel in Luke 2, the angels keep appearing and they say, the sign of the new age is a baby laying in a manger. They say it three times in Luke chapter 2. And you wonder, what? You kind of say, what's that got to do with anything? Come and have a look at the sign of the new age, the new thing that God is doing, the new kingdom. And it's like a baby in a manger, in a crib, in a stable. And you say, well, what's that about? Again, we sing about it every year. And you only ever ask these questions if you have to preach on the passages. And it's like, what's that about? Well, I'll tell you what that's about. It's about rejection. It's actually saying the family would not allow a pregnant woman to have the baby in the house because the house would get polluted because she was unclean, she was a sinner, she was an outcast, and so the best we can do is find you where the animals hang out and you can have the baby there because really that is where we see you in terms of our family structures. Do you know whose family that was? Joseph's family. Now, let's say you're the senior pastor of Jerusalem, and that happens to be your family, your side of the family. How keen are you on that story? Yeah, wouldn't you prefer Joseph to be the hero? That makes sense, doesn't it? Joseph's the key figure. And yeah, I'm related to Joseph, by the way. And that's my suggestion on how you've got the contrast between Matthew and Luke in terms of the story. One was actually set in Jerusalem where the senior pastor had an influence on the way the story was told. I know that might all freak you out, but it also tells us something about what is happening here in Luke. Because Luke is a story about rejection, and it's about family rejection. In fact, I actually think that the story of Matthew and Luke might even suggest that there were still little tensions between Joseph's side of the family and Mary's side of the family. Interestingly, there's a way of linking Luke's gospel to Jude, Jesus' brother. The genealogy that appears in Luke chapter 3 is actually based on an obscure Jewish text, or not so obscure, if you're a New Testament scholar, called the Book of Enoch. And it's got to do with 77 generations. I'm not talking about it just now, but it's what it's got to do with. And it comes out of the Book of Enoch. And you know the only person who references the Book of Enoch in the whole of the New Testament? Is Jude, Jesus' brother, in the letter that he writes. Very interesting little connection, family connection, possibly between Jude and Luke and the story that's going on. But maybe there was a tension between Mary's side of the family and Joseph's side of the family. Maybe Mary's side of the family had never quite come to terms with the way that Joseph's side of the family rejected her at that critical point, how they missed it, how they missed what God was doing, how they expressed in an unloving, uncaring, unspiritual fashion that rejection of Jesus. Maybe these two stories are actually reflecting something of that. Whatever, we know that Luke is saying that in the baby in the manger, we have a symbol of rejection. And here in the midst of that symbol of rejection, the baby lying in the manger, we have the declaration of the new age. What is the declaration of the new age for Luke? Well, you find it in the Magnificat, the song that Mary sings. It's actually declaring that God will be discovered amongst the marginalized, amongst those on the fringes, amongst those who are poor. He will not be discovered amongst the palaces and the powerful, but you will discover him when you go and you interact with the marginalized, with the rejected. You see, for some of us, we all put a brave face as we come to Christmas. And the reality is we're papering over maybe those hurts. Maybe what that member of my family did to me. Maybe the way that my mother related to me or my father rejected me. Or the way that my brother behaved. Or the things that my sister said. Or the way that my son or my daughter hurt me after all that I gave them. And Christmas, we paper over it. But actually, for many of us, Christmas is a story of rejection. Christmas is a story of the pain and the hurt. And as we read these narratives, and I know we lose it in our lovely, pristine nativity services that are so much fun and hilarious, but actually, these are stories that reflect some of the greatest pain of any of the stories that you will find in the New Testament. And the story here in Luke is a story of Mary being rejected. And it's a remarkable story because it affirms in the midst of that rejection, not only that God is working, even in the midst of the marginalized and the rejected, but it's affirming that God is still sovereign and at work in the midst of that situation. You see, look, apart from affirming the notion of rejection and the marginalized in his story, also affirms this wonderful sense of God's sovereignty in the midst of the chaos and the pain that was happening. Sometimes it's hard to believe, if you're hurting and you're in a situation of pain, that God is still there. It's hard sometimes to believe that God is still sovereign. It's hard to actually see in the midst of the darkness that we sometimes experience in our lives and the pain that we sometimes experience in our lives, any kind of light. And yeah, we sing our Christmas carols and we pull our crackers and we put on our funny hats, but we're just covering and masking the reality of that pain. And yet in the midst of that, Luke affirms something of God's sovereignty. Luke does two interesting things in the annunciation that the angel makes to Mary. First of all, he tells her that she is to call the baby Jesus. There's a reason for that. And then he says he will be the Son of the Most High. And then he goes on to say, and he'll have the throne of his father David. And his kingdom will persist forever as he reigns. And he affirms these three ideas. In most of the New Testament, when the term Son of God is used, it doesn't mean that Jesus is divine, right? In the New Testament, in the way it's being used. That was a later inference that the Christian church after the creeds began to put on it. It actually is a reference to divine title. So you'll read, especially in Matthew's gospel, that Jesus is described as a king, Son of God. And so it's basically a title of sovereignty or power or kingship. And you'll see that in Matthew, that when he affirms that he is the Son of the Most High, what's that in relation to? It's in relation to the idea that he is going to reign as his father David did, and his kingdom will persist forever. And it's a strong affirmation. And that's the way, if you read the New Testament, you'll see it being used predominantly in that way. However, Luke does something really interesting a few verses on. Just so you don't worry about my orthodoxy here. You'll actually notice that Luke uniquely, or not quite uniquely, but certainly in a very distinctive way, associates the title Son of God with the idea of the incarnation. Because the next time he uses it, and New Testament scholars are reluctant to admit that anybody calls Jesus divine in parts of the Bible, but there is very clearly something going on, because what happens is the angel says, Mary says, how am I going to get pregnant? And the angel says, well, God's going to overshadow you. And then he says, and if God overshadows you, the child that is conceived will be known as holy and as the Son of God. And so what Luke does there is he associates the title Son of God with actually the idea of the incarnation. And that later became the basis of a lot of theology that we have. So there is a notion in terms of the Son of God as actually divine. But for Luke and for Matthew, what was at the heart of the Nativity was not the affirmation that God has been born into the world. What was at the heart of the Nativity was the notion that God is sovereign, and that God intervenes in our world, and that God addresses our brokenness. And so when it's declaring Son of God, what it's declaring is that God breaks into your world. God is sovereign and addresses your world. And so when we see the affirmation of Son of God, and I know because of Christian theology, we all race to the incarnation. And I promise I will preach at some point on the wonder of the incarnation, and I do believe in the incarnation. But actually, the emphasis in both Matthew and Luke doesn't sit there. Came later. It sits with the idea of God's sovereignty. And here's the thing. For us as we sit, maybe with hurt, as we're processing rejection, as we're processing what's happened in terms of our family. And maybe for some of us, that's been really problematic. Maybe it's been something that's not just been a breach in a relationship, but maybe it's been abusive in some form. And it's left us damaged and with shadows that we carry through the whole of our life. The message of Christmas to those who feel rejected, to those who know brokenness, to those who know the pain of family breakdown, is that God is sovereign and he wants to intervene in your world. You see, Luke says you'll discover the meaning of Christmas as you look at the babe in the manger. And you understand that he is a God who understands what it is to be rejected. He is a God who understands what it is to be on the margins. He is a God who understands the pain and the hurt that comes with all of that. And yet, God is at work. You know, the amazing thing about this story is that God drew out of it because of his sovereign activity and the sovereign reign of Christ that was expressed through the babe in the manger. God brought something amazing and wonderful. You know, so that 2,000 years later, we're still celebrating with nativity scenes in our church. And what I want you to know this morning as we think about Christmas is that whatever you're doing in terms of family this year, whatever the degree of brokenness, whatever the degree of pain, whatever the degree of rejection that you may feel, I want you to know that Jesus came to be sovereign, to be the Son of David and the Son of God, to reign, and to reign in your situation, and to know that God can take your situation, and although it may seem hopeless, it may seem dark, to bring the light that transforms that into something wonderful. This Christmas, I invite you to be open to God's intervention in your situation. Let's pray.